So, Cam, have you been following any of the stuff with the royal family since we're talking about Britannia today?
Nope.
Okay. So, like, you don't know anything about how, like, half the royal family's, like, missing and or, like, suspiciously in the hospital or something?
I mean, I know that the king has cancer.
Right? Yeah.
And he's, like, dropped off the radar. And there was some controversy around that because he's always been, like, a proponent of, like, holistic medicine. And,
yeah.
Like, avoiding, like, chemotherapy and things.
Yeah, and he's also, yeah. They said that it wasn't, like, that bad. That wasn't, like, that serious. But then he immediately started working on, like, his succession plan. So that's already, like, giving people pause thinking that it's, like...
Well, they have to do that.
Yeah, but thinking that, like, maybe it's, like, worse than it says. But you don't know anything about, like, Kate Middleton?
I know that she was in the hospital. Maybe I do know more about this than...
Yeah.
I don't know. I know she was in the hospital, and there's, like, a lot of speculation in the media about what
yeah.
she was in the hospital for. And that's it. That's the extent of my knowledge. I know that
yeah.
Kate Middleton was in the hospital, and people were like, why? And
yeah.
then the king got himself some cancer, and
yeah.
people are like, oh, no. And I think the funny thing about that is that, like, I feel like... And this isn't, like, a hot take or anything, but I feel
mm-hmm.
like people have often speculated that, like... Queen Elizabeth II would live forever, and then
yeah.
her son would inherit and then, like, die within a year.
Yeah.
You know? Because he's just, like, I mean, those are some swollen feet, bro.
Dude, yeah, he's clearly got, like, heart problems and shit, you
yeah,
know what I mean?
Not, he doesn't look good. He looks,
yeah.
like, very red and very, very, very
swollen, bad,
filled.
Yeah,
yeah.
Bad circulation or something.
Yeah.
yeah, but so I was brought up a bit to speed on the Kate Middleton thing from a buddy of mine at work who's been, like, kind of, like, following it.
Sure.
But, like, yeah, so she, like, came down with... So the last time she was seen in public was last year, at the end of last year. And, like, so she, like, came down with some mysterious ailment. And, like, in the press release, they said that, like, oh, yeah, so that she's going in for a planned abdominal surgery. But then, like, two sentences later, they say that due to this, that she's had to cancel upcoming engagements. And then Prince William had to cancel upcoming engagements, which... really doesn't make sense if it was a planned procedure. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you're playing the procedure, why'd you plan engagements for, like, the rest of the week and, like, the weeks after?
Right.
And so there's that. And, like, so then, like, yeah, Prince William has kind of dropped off from, like, public view and whatnot due to this. And, like, he canceled, like, there's, like, a bunch of other members of the family that are sick. Like, there's, I think Prince Andrew's, like, first wife. She's, like, MIA and sick, I believe. And then there's, one of the people that are from, like, the royal family in Greece, which is, like, you know, the same family, obviously, Philip was from that royal family. They just died, and then Prince William, like, canceled going to his funeral. And, like, they're still, like, being, like, very coy about what's going on with Kate Middleton.
Yeah.
And saying that she won't be making a public appearance until after Easter, which again is like, okay, if this was a planned thing, like you've had to cancel like 2 months worth of like 2 months plus like worth of like public engagements. It just like so like a lot of like what they're saying really just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And
what do you think she's having like a hysterectomy or something?
Or the surgery went poorly, or maybe this clearly wasn't planned. Maybe I don't know, maybe she has like stomach cancer or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
But like either that or some weird arcane reptilian disease is taking out the royal family one by one, or some scourge of Satan or something.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Well, fuck. I mean, who's to say? And,
yeah.
I can't say that I'm especially worried about it.
Yeah.
Not too broken up about the death.
Rest
of the
in
royals.
Piss, yeah.
But not you know, I don't know. I know that over there the like the tabloid media is like fucking bonkers over the royals, and they have like
yeah.
a whole segment of the British media that's like entirely devoted to like Royal Watch 24/7.
Yeah.
Which we like sort of have with like presidents and stuff, but there's just a
yeah.
different level of like cultural obsession and grandeur when you have like a hereditary royal family, I think
mm-hmm.
that we just don't have like a real understanding of here because we
yeah.
don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they're all losing their minds over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all the people that talk about the royals are like the poshest, Shittiest. Well, I hate to speculate, but of course, as we know, the king has rather checkered history when it comes to traditional Western medicine. Yes, yeah. So of course, while we hope for his speedy recovery, we must also conjecture about the possibility that he's embarking on a regimen of coffee enemas and the like to flush out the system of the cancer rather than undergo the chemotherapy. Yeah. You know, like that sort of thing.
Yeah. But yeah, so anyway. And
one
yeah,
of the few accents I'm still like allowed to do.
Yeah. Yeah, you've lost the
I can do a lot of them, but they're not allowed anymore, so.
Yeah, kind of iffy. But yeah, no, anyway, I was kidding before about the reptilian thing. I don't think they're reptilians. I think they're amphibians.
I don't believe in, like, the reptilian shit, but, like, if anybody was gonna be reptilian, it would be that fucking weirdo family.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I don't think they are. I think they're just, like, shitty people.
Yep. All right, anyway, so welcome to another exciting episode of Left Unread. I am your host, Evan, joined, as always, by my also-host, Cameron. Cameron, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. You know what I've noticed is that you, I don't know, on episodes that you host, you never let me introduce myself.
Yeah, but you do that to me too.
No, I don't.
Yeah, you do. You literally
This is, and I wait, and then you're always caught off guard.
Nope. You also say this, and this is Evan. You've literally said that on like either the last one or the one before that.
Maybe I started doing it because you never let me say my own name. I feel disenfranchised by you.
Okay. Well, all right. So. I am Evan, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host.
Evan. Fuck!
Yep. Also, briefly, I do want to say, so you've been watching Shogun on FX, right?
Yeah, there's a new episode coming out tomorrow, and I'm fucking amped.
Yeah, I have, like, a few minutes left on the second episode, but I started that this week, too. It's really good.
It's so good.
And also, for fans of the show who are maybe more recent, Cameron did a three-part series on basically this era of Japanese history. Yeah. They have fictionalized versions of the characters. Although, like the main character from this show, he's called like Torinaga, but he's supposed to be like what was his name?
Well, yeah. Since I did the episodes, I can talk a little bit about it. So Shogun's one of my favorite books of all time. Right, great book. You should read it. The show is really good, and the main. One of the main characters of the book Shogun is Torinaga Yoshi, who is a pastiche of Tokugawa Ieyasu and other, you know. But he's supposed to be Tokugawa Ieyasu, who is the focus of part three of my Sengoku era episodes. And they also touch on, you know, there are a couple scenes with the dying Taiko, which was Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who was called the Taiko. Yep. So, yeah, we talk about a lot of that stuff on my episodes. Definitely worth going back and listening. And then, obviously, like, a lot of the things in this show are drama. But it's all based in historical fact, right? So, you know, the idea of the Portuguese having this sort of self-professed right to trade in East Asia and that being challenged by the Dutch and the British at this time in, like, 1600 is all legit. and, you know, the idea of Christianity entering Japan. It was a really interesting time in that country, and the show, I think, captures it really well. And they've done a lot. So those of you who have either read the novel, which is an older book, I think it came out in the 70s, or who have seen the original miniseries that came out in the 80s, that miniseries is hokey as hell, and it really highlighted the, like, forbidden romance aspect of the novel, which is there, like the idea of this like British privateer and this Japanese noblewoman having a love affair, right? Like, that's spicy, and it's definitely in the story, and I think it'll be in this show too. But I know in this adaptation they've really made sure to emphasize historical accuracy with costumes and naming
hairstyles and shit.
And the lead actor, whose name just jumped right out of my head.
The guy who plays Blackthorn, or the guy who plays Torinaga?
Oh, well, that dude. So his name is Cosmo Jarvis.
I know. I saw that, like, dude. Cosmo. I thought that was only. I thought Cosmo was only a name in Seinfeld.
I think it's his middle name, but
He uses it as his first name, though.
Yes, he's got chronic dumb face, which is which is hysterical, and the name Cosmo Jarvis, and then you see this dude, and he's just got this fucking bulldog dummy face.
Yeah.
But he's actually very good in the show, and I'm impressed. But Hiroyuki Sanada, who is...
He's awesome.
People over here probably know him most. He, like, made it big in the West. He was a secondary protagonist in The Last Samurai, which is a dumb fucking movie, but he's awesome in it, and he's an expert in... traditional Japanese martial arts, and like an amateur, but, you know, well-regarded historian of this era.
Yeah,
so he's like a producer and creative consultant on the show too, and he's done a lot to.
He's also he was in Westworld, and he was in one other prestige TV show. I can't remember what.
Yeah, he's been you've seen him before.
Yeah.
He's a fairly recognizable actor. He's huge in Japan.
Yeah.
He was in a really great movie called Twilight Samurai. Which is a fucking awesome movie that you should absolutely watch.
Yeah.
But so it's a great show. Highly recommend it.
So anyway, I guess let's get into the meat of this episode. As I said in the open, we are traveling, folks. We are traveling back to Britannia, and so this is part 6 of my Ancient Mysteries series.
Wait, Britannia? Do you mean like where Aeneas of Troy went and fought the giants?
The very same island. Yes, that's right.
That's what I was thinking. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. We've taken many sojourns to this island, both in the History of the Kings of Britain series, and as well as your Julius Caesar's Conquest of Gaul series.
Yep,
and we'll be touching back on this episode. But yeah, so I wanted to continue the Ancient Mystery series today by taking a look at the mud-soaked blue naked men of Britannia and their various strange gods and rituals, and the druids, and the coming of the Romans, and the blending of, you know, the Romanitas and cults of the Roman Empire as they intermingled with the Britons. Yeah.
The coming of the Romans, dude. I'm fucking excited.
Yeah, dude. Yep, absolutely. They were just straight busting. But yeah, so so I'd like to start by this quote from Herodian. "Most of Britain is marshland. The barbarians usually swim in these swamps or run along in them, submerged up to the waist. Of course, they are practically naked and do not mind the mud because they are unfamiliar with the use of clothing, and they adorn their waists and necks with iron. They also tattoo their bodies with various patterns and pictures of all sorts of animals. Hence the reason why they do not wear clothing, so as not to cover the pictures on their bodies." And I like to imagine that Britain is still like this, you know? The Britain in my heart is like this.
They're just like, I just love that the first thing he says, it's full of swamps and mud, and they just fucking roll around naked because they're gross, dude.
Well, and you know what reminds me of the day when the UK had that, like, insane heat wave. I think it was, like, 2 summers ago.
And the dude was sitting in his fucking trash can.
Yeah, and he's just like...
What do you mean I'm not allowed to take a bath in my own bin?
He's, like, indignant that his neighbor's just like, dude, what kind of nasty bullshit are you doing? Yeah, exactly.
He filled
that
own,
dude...
like, his own trash bin with water and was just sitting in it.
Yeah, Literally, yeah, just his head poking out the top.
Which,
like,
honestly,
Oscar the Grouch.
I think that fucking rules, dude. Yeah. I wasn't even, when I saw that, I was impressed. There was no disgust, no nothing.
Yeah.
Good for him.
He knew exactly what he was going to do when temperatures reached
his culture.
When temperatures reached 35 Celsius, yeah, his ass was dumping in the garbage bin.
You think
the
he
rubbish
pissed in
bin.
There?
It didn't look
easy to get out of. He definitely wasn't like.
He may as well have. I mean, that shit was definitely caked with, like, fucking, you know, dirty old beans and shit.
So. Maybe it was his recycling one, which would still be gross, but not as bad.
Yeah, plenty of, like, beer, like, caked into the corners and shit on it.
Are you enjoying the weather there, mate?
What?
Are you enjoying the weather there?
What are you talking about?
I said, are you enjoying the weather there?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. Am I not allowed?
Yeah, but you're in the bin.
Oh, Jesus. The moment you try and do anything, someone comes along and tries to stop you.
Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, that man's probably got some ancient Brythonic blood in him or something. So we discussed in the initial sojourn into the island of Britannia by the Romans under Julius Caesar in the Julius Caesar Goes on Holiday series, which are mainly about Caesar's Gallic Wars, but include his trips to the island. So this was the first real encounter between the Romans and the Britons, but it would not be until around 100 years later when the Emperor Claudius of Claudius fame sent his legions to the island, and that's when it would come under Roman rule. Caesar basically just went there to, like, smack around a bunch of naked dudes, like, just let them know that, you know, the Romans were here, you know. So even still, as the Herodian quote I began this episode with shows, even 150 to 200 years after Caesar, the Britons were still portrayed as different from the civilized mainland European Romans. Might I add, for good reason. So, beginning with Caesar, it is likely that a sort of obsedes, or friendly hostage, program began, wherein leaders of the British tribes would send their sons to Roman courts in order to get properly Romanized and learn about Roman law, culture, and learn to write and speak Greek and Latin.
Yeah, we know how they were getting properly Romanized, I'll
tell
you.
That intracurural shit, dude. They were,
blonde and blue-eyed, sweet boy, you must be properly Romanized, indoctrinated. Yeah. Latin.
Let me see those thighs, and I'll teach you the ways
Roman,
of the classics.
Roman by injection, boy.
I'm trying to say they fucked these boys, probably.
Yeah, they were fucking putting these boys into, you know, right into the pillows. But naturally, these obsedes would meet others from across to the Near East and North Africa. And there would be a cultural blending upon their return. Yeah, I mean, I imagine they would, like, go back to Britannia and just, like, absolutely be lording over these fucking naked blue bastards.
I forgot all you do is swim in the mud.
In the swamps and bogs.
Cover your penises, please.
Yep. So in his Commentariae de Bello Gallico, Julius Caesar writes that he initially went to Britannia during his conquest of Gaul, as the Gauls routinely received reinforcements from the island. But the Gauls really did not know much about the region, save for the coastline directly across the English Channel from Normandy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, here I'm using the modern names just to make it easier for us to figure out where we are. So for the most part, the only people who really knew the region from the mainland were traders, and Caesar desired a better look at the land. So Caesar describes his initial sojourn into Britannia as being a hard-fought landing on the beaches just across from Gaul, with the Britons harassing him and his troops on the beaches. So the Romans initially struggled mightily to land on the beaches of Britannia, as the Britons lobbed javelins and used their cavalry and chariots to keep the Romans from a clean landing. But eventually his legions were able to make it off the warships and onto the beaches and send flight to the Britons, who quickly sued for peace, being the vile little worms that they were, and bowed to Caesar's demands. And that's basically Caesar's language. That the second they were able to get landing, he was like, oh yes, then they sued for peace immediately. However, tragedy struck. The high Atlantic tides damaged Caesar's ground ships and stranded his legions on Britannia after they had expected a brief stay. And so hostilities by these treacherous Britons were resumed by the tribal chiefs of the island.
Right. We talked about this in my Caesar episodes a little bit, about how, like, you can kind of read between the lines here and see that, like, yeah, Caesar. So Caesar landed finally and like had like one like pretty stunning victory.
By
his account. Yeah. And then they were like, okay, yeah, yeah, we give up, and they left. And then he realized he was stuck there. And of course he, you know what I mean? So he talked about conquering Britain, but really he like landed, won a skirmish. Then when he realized he couldn't just run away, like with the victory under his belt, and the Britons were like, oh, we have time to like regroup and get reinforcements. Yeah.
And like, and all work together. All. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Caesar was like, but you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So eventually he was able to, you know, defeat in some respect the Britons again and sue for even harsher terms of peace. And then he retreated back to the continent to wait out the winter and plan the next Roman invasion of Britannia. And, like, all of his ships were, like, damaged and shit. And so he had to, like, they had to, like, scuttle a bunch of ships and, like, take pieces from the ships that they scuttled to, like, fix the other ones.
Yeah. The Romans were not good at open ocean naval expeditions.
Yeah. They were
The relatively calm Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And even that, they were not seafaring people. They co-opted, Phoenician or Punic and Greek captains and naval technology, basically. And
I mean, that's what they were really good at was taking what other people did and just making it better, but improving it with that Roman work ethic. So like basically, like what happened is like he grounded the ships for them to like get off, and then like he didn't realize how high the tide got. In the Atlantic, and when the tides came in, it like basically like lifted up all of the ships, and like some of them got like flooded and whatnot, and just damaged them, and they just started banging around and hitting each other and everything like that, because they were all like, you know, ground. He thought they were like safely like grounded on the beach, but it just really caused like a lot of havoc and like destroyed a lot of their food and all that kind of stuff, all the grain and whatnot.
Do you ever watch Home Movies?
I've watched it with you. Okay. And I had seen it when I was a kid. I think my dad maybe watched it a little bit or something like that. I can't really remember. I remember seeing it a bit when I was a kid. But yeah, I've watched it with you.
There's this really great Coach McGurk quote about how to properly survive a tornado.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that. And I'm going to play it quickly for you, the audio, and then you can decide if you want to put it in here, because I think it would be funny.
All right.
Emergency. A tornado warning is in effect right now. This is a tornado alert. Get to a shelter or a basement immediately.
Oh my god. Oh man, what do we do? Brendan? Melissa? Yeah. Jason?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
A tornado's coming.
Coach, are you crying?
No, I'm not crying.
Wait, Coach, is tornadoes really coming?
Yeah, that's what the radio said. There's a tornado coming. So I'm gonna stay down here with the baby. You guys go upstairs and play.
Shouldn't we stay down here with you?
No. It's not safe for everybody to be in the same place during a tornado, Melissa.
But I thought you're supposed to go to
No, the rule is, Melissa, you separate.
Are you sure?
Yeah. You get sucked into the funnel, and everyone's separated. It's just like a fun ride. But if you're all in a group, in a cluster, you start banging into each other, and then your heads collide, and you die.
Wow.
Oh, my God, I gotta check out my sister's flight.
Anyway.
Yeah. That's basically what happened.
You get sucked up in the tornado, and everyone's separate. It's just like a fun ride. If you're all clumped together, your heads collide and you die.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, all right. So they spend the winter in Gaul. And then once the winter passes, the second invasion would begin the following year. And Caesar claims that 800 Roman ships this time made their way to Britannia. And at the sight of such a large force, the Britons fled from the beaches in fear of the ire of Caesar. He also does say that, like, they, like, misjudged, like, the winds and whatnot, and he ends up all of a sudden looking out and realizing that, like, behind them on the port side was, like, where he, like, intended to land, because he had, like, scouted the landing zone. So, all in all, a little bit of a bumpy introduction to Britannia for the Romans here.
Sure, yeah.
So fighting would ensue, as well as more ship catastrophes, but the Romans would be successful. And Caesar describes the inhabitants thusly. All the Britons dye the whole of their bodies except the head and the upper lip. Wives are shared between groups of 10 or 12 men, especially between brothers and between fathers and sons. But the offspring of these unions are counted as the children of the man with whom a particular woman cohabited first. Yeah, so, you know, it's fucking rancid.
Like, just, like, definitely not true.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Brothers are tag teaming each other's wives. Fathers and sons are getting down with the same woman. They're just, nobody knows whose kid is whose, you know?
Yeah. I don't know, and I'm sure there are specific examples where I'm wrong, but it's pretty rare in human societies for like fathers and sons to like fuck the same lady. It's not a, you know, that's like a pretty standard cultural taboo.
Yeah.
Across human society, just because we have that sort of ingrained in our DNA, like, hey, let's try to avoid kind of incest and the way that that works, you know. So my guess is this is probably a fabrication on Caesar's part.
But then there is like Zoroastrian Swedota, or however you pronounce it.
Yeah, but even that isn't the actual history around that pretty dubious. Like, there's not a lot of recorded examples of that being a common practice. You know, it might have occurred.
Yeah,
and it's definitely worth pursuing in Crusader Kings.
I was about to say, unless you go on the Crusader Kings subreddit, and then it's real big.
Yeah. I mean, that game is basically just like an incest simulator.
Yeah, it's like an incest in like a war crime simulator.
Oh, stepbrother, my claims.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Her. Your sister's ample tracts of land.
Large tracts of land.
Yeah. So anyway, in discussions with the locals of the island, Caesar and the Romans ascertained that Britannia was probably around 1,900 miles in circumference, and that the regions now known as Kent in the far southeast of Britannia was by far the most civilized and mainly populated by peoples from the continent. They learned of the existence of Ireland, around half the size of Britannia. It was reported, and to the west, and also the existence of the Isle of Man, and some smaller islands in between the two large land masses. There were other rumors of regions of the islands that had a month-long night in the winter, although obviously that isn't possible as the islands don't reach into the Arctic Circle. You know,
they were not in the night country, folks.
They were not. Unlike the rest of us, we're all in the night country.
We're all in the night country.
But
now.
They weren't in the night country.
Yeah, and but all of us are.
Yeah, yeah. So after subduing the warring tribes of Britannia and feeling like he had achieved some form of peace, even if uneasy, Caesar once again set sail back to Gaul before the winter equinox, content with having achieved victory in Britannia. Of course, the Romans were not done on that continent, not by a long shot. And yeah, so I just want to give some thoughts. So obviously, my sources for this episode, as I just said, were Julius Caesar's The Conquest of Gaul, Commentarii de Bello Gallico. And the main one is this book, Sacred Britannia, by Miranda Althaus Green. I also used like some online sources just to like double check things and whatnot. But those are the two main ones. And the Miranda Althaus Green one, it's a well-written book. It's definitely like a pop history book, but it's good. It's well written. However, it's very, very 2018, which I believe is when this was released. And it's just like, man, like you forget like how bad the culture of everything was back then.
Mainly because we're just still living in like the mutant offspring of that era, and like it's just getting worse.
Yeah, but like that was like the big time when like all like pop historians. Miranda Althaus Green's like a professor. She's got a doctorate, but like you had all these pop history books coming out that were like likening everything that was happening in the West at that time to, you know, certain aspects, especially in the Roman Empire. And like, yeah, like, so like literally like the second page, this author is like likening, the treatment of the Romans, to the Britons as like Donald Trump and like, you know, him wanting to build the border wall. And it's just like, and again, like within like the first, you know, few dozen pages, she's like talking about Brexit and like likening things in this to, you know, the rise of the alt-right and like, yeah, like I said, Brexit and Donald Trump.
Well, Brexit would have made a lot of sense if you were a British tribesman. And the Romans were arriving. You would have been like,
Boudicca was the first Brexiter.
Yeah, let's keep these Europeans out of here. And I would have agreed at the time. You know, that would have made a lot of sense. Let's get these fucking Romans out of Britain, dude.
Yeah.
Britain for the British, simple as.
Yeah. But yeah, so it was just, it was very much like, and it's fucking crazy to think that 2018 was like, goddamn, like
six years ago,
yeah. But yeah, it was very, it just reminded me of how everything at that time was always about Trump, and then if you were in Great Britain about Brexit and all that. So yeah, it was really, really like a little time capsule in that regard. But yeah, anyway,
that's sort of the beauty of history, Evan.
Yeah,
it's you get an opportunity to experience to the best of our ability the way people felt and thought at an earlier time, even though you know, that time is gone, you know?
Yep. Yep, you can remember just how annoying some things were.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah. So yeah, that was really dreadful. But other than that, really good book that I enjoyed.
Sacred Britannia?
Yeah.
By Miranda Aldhouse Green.
Yep. The Gods and Rituals of Roman Britain.
Nice.
So, So to start off this short sub-series on the pagan rituals and mystery cults of Roman Britain, I would first like to start by looking at the landscape of religion in Roman Britain just before the arrival of the Romans. Naturally, we will be looking at the Druidic cults. I also want to look at the coming of the Romans, as we just did, and Roman polytheism, and how Roman polytheism blended with the native gods and rituals of Britannia. So when the Romans came to Britain, the Druids still held significant power and influence. However, they were seen as barbaric by the Romans, with Pliny the Elder denouncing them as cannibals who practiced human sacrifice. You know, and from this, we can see that the Druids were really at odds with Romanitas, and they represented sort of like a separate pole of influence and power on the island at the coming of these Southron invaders. Caesar himself describes Gaulish human sacrifice as occurring, including in, quote, enormous images made of wickerwork, limbs of which they fill with living men.
Not the bees!
Not the bees!
What is that? What is that? What is it? Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah! Oh, no, my eyes! My eyes! Ah!
I actually just watched the Nick Cage one.
Dude, how many women does he punch in that movie? It's at least two or three, right?
Dude, there's one part where he just that's like five. Dude, there's one part where he just clocks this woman while wearing a bear costume.
Oh my god, dude. Yeah. So here's the thing. People were all taken aback when Midsommar came out, and I was like, you guys don't understand. This movie already came out 15 years ago.
Two times, really. Man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so the original The Wicker Man is like one of my favorite horror movies. The one that came out in the 70s. And that one's just amazing. It's so good. And honestly, so I watched the Nick Cage one last night for the first time. And it's on the Criterion Channel. Unfortunately, they show the 102-minute version, not the 104-minute, where they cut out the bee scene, which is like really baffling.
They cut out the bee scene?
Yeah, so like this is the final cut where they cut that out. However, what they do is so like in that scene, Nick Cage gets both of his legs broken and then has like the mask put on him where they like get him stung by bees, and it's right before he gets put in the Wicker Man. But for some reason, so like they keep the like audio of him being like tortured, but they just put it over like you can hear it like. While he's like being carried, so like it's supposed to be like they just kind of skip over the torture, but you can still hear it. But he's just being carried at that point, and then all of a sudden you look at him, and now he just randomly has two broken legs and like bee stings all over his face, but you don't see it happen. Very, very baffling choice. But also, I will say, like that movie's like considered to be like one of the worst movies ever. I think that's kind of an unfair characterization. It wasn't a good movie, but it wasn't like terrible. It was just like kind of like normal, kind of bad, not horrifically bad.
It was palatable.
Yeah, exactly. Like it was fine. It wasn't like good. It wasn't like
Madame Web.
Yeah, or even Morbius or anything like that. Even though it has like that reputation, it was fine. It was definitely worse for the wear from that cut though. When they took that out, it just made no sense. And you're like, where are all the bee stings on his face? And plus, it's just a hysterical scene. I highly recommend the original Wicker Man. And the Nick Cage one's decent, I guess. So the Romans themselves did not outlaw ritual human sacrifice until the 1st century BCE. But quickly, you see Roman sources obviously getting on a soapbox about not long after. Learn from their mistakes, I suppose. I will say, it's very funny that the author, Miranda Altos Green, she's British, and like you can tell she's definitely like coming at this like that the Romans are very unfair. They treat them very unfairly, folks. They're very nasty to the Britons. But like she like makes a point saying it's like what the Romans didn't outlaw human sacrifice until like 50 years before they came to Britannia. But you know they were really quick to criticize the Britons for still doing it. I was like. Yeah, but like 50 years, that would be like a different Roman ruling class at that point. And I feel like that's a good thing for them to be like, yeah, it was really fucked up that we used to do this. So you guys like, it's really fucked up that you guys do this. Like, she's, like, saying it like they don't have any, like, leg to stand on. But it's, like, I don't know.
That's a really common take that people have with history in general, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, there are a lot of Americans who will get on their high horse about, like, oh, like, the British gave us such a hard time about slavery. Well, they used to do it, too. It's like, yeah, but it was good that they outlawed it and that their
culture
shifted
towards... And it was good that they gave you a hard time, yeah.
Yeah, it was good that their culture shifted towards viewing it as abhorrent, right? Yeah.
And now, of course, they were still willing to benefit from American slave labor.
Exactly. So but, it's not that I'm whitewashing the hypocrisy there.
Yeah.
Or the motivations behind a lot of, like, the economic interests that, you know, the British had in the U.S. slave trade. But, you know, so, like, there's a certain element of the, like, looking down the nose that I understand chafing at that. But, like, ultimately, it's good that societies progress in those directions, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
I don't know that I've ever found it, like, a particularly compelling take to be, like, basically to make the case that this author's making, right? Like, that,
Oh,
well, they themselves only just, you know, people do the same thing in reverse with China right now, you know, with their emissions and stuff. When people look at Chinese emissions and say, like, well, this is crazy, they have to curb it, it's unacceptable. And the Chinese response to that is generally, well, you guys did it, so now we're going to do it. And it's like, but, like, no one should do it.
Yeah, that one does have, like, a separate thing, I think, just because, like the emissions are, like, generally speaking, like and then China has been curbing that, but, like, you know, it's also, like, that's, like, necessarily entwined with, like, technological advancement. So, like, there is definitely hypocrisy in the West, and first of all, that the West doesn't at all even attempt to really control their emissions, but then, like, also, like, that, like, the reason that the West is, like, getting on a soapbox isn't because that's a bad thing, but rather because it, like, means that, like, technological, like, that there's, like, a closing gap in, like, technological advancement. So, in that way, like, it is a little bit different there, but, I mean, still, yeah, I mean, like, like I said, it was just very weird that, like, to, like, get on, like, oh, but Romans were doing human sacrifices, like, 50 years before this, so they don't really have, like, a leg to stand on. It's like, yeah, those are different people, though. Like, you know what I mean? It's been, like, long enough that these are different people who are, like, talking about it now, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, So obviously it's difficult to evaluate the salacious claims of human sacrifice by Roman sources that had reason to portray the Brits as barbarians needing Roman civilization, but there is archaeological evidence that supports the claim of people being bound and burned ritualistically. So there's the case of the Lindo man in Cheshire, who died in the mid-first century CE and was submerged in the bog, and the case of a young boy whose skull, which had been defleshed, showed signs of wear at the base, indicating it was mounted on a pole and displayed at a shrine in the 2nd century Verulamium in present-day Hertfordshire. A lot of these, like, Roman British towns have, like, really, really crazy names. Like, difficult to say. But the Lindo man was bludgeoned in the head, strangled, and had his throat slit before he was pushed headfirst and naked into a remote marsh pool.
Well, he shouldn't be upset about that. That's the British loved being naked in marsh pools.
I know, really. That's the ideal way to go. Yeah. So he appears to have been a man born of some stature. You know, didn't really have, like, a lot of, like, physical wear on his person. And there was debate over his death, but it is widely believed to have been a ritual murder. Although, I guess, yeah, and that's, like, historical consensus, but also, like, I don't know, man, maybe he slept with one of their wives and wasn't a brother or father. Yeah. As for the child, the child in Verulamium, its head was carefully skinned after a massive head injury before being displayed outside a temple. So, there is some archaeological evidence. Now, the Roman governor of Britain in 60 CE... Suetonius Paulinus was written by Tacitus as having demolished the sacred groves of the Isle of Mona, now known as Anglesey, off the northwest coast of Wales. The island is still known today in a similar name, in Welsh as Ynys Môn. This island was supposedly a major holy site for the Druids, and, indeed, the county of Anglesey even still includes an island called simply Holy Island. The Royal Air Force in 1942 excavated a region named Lindkerigbak on Anglesey while an airbase went under construction, and they discovered a large amount of Iron Age metalwork from the region dating to between the 4th century BCE and 2nd century CE, indicating widespread and long-lasting travel to the region and many of the found items being of religious significance. So many of the items at Lindkerigbak were attributed to animal sacrifice, and some remains of animals were discovered to coincide with the depictions and tools of such. The site has not been definitively linked to Druidic rituals, but it matches the testimony of Tacitus to Suetonius Paulinus' destruction of a Druidic grove. And watery locales were often chosen as holy sites for pagan rituals around the world, mainly as a means of communicating or communing with gods and spirits that were in some way represented by or synonymous with water. And likewise, islands were considered to be, quote, thin locations, wherein the sacred and the mundane world more closely intersected from their individual realms. Iceland, for instance, was at one time home to a small monastic community of Irish Catholic monks before the arrival of the Vikings, and a similar community was out on Skellig Michael, 8 miles from the coast of Ireland. Thin locations are seen also in Greece, with old temples and monasteries suspended over cliff faces to bodies of water. Now, Celtic myths about spiritual locales on islands, such as the Isle of Apple Trees, which coincides with the myth of King Arthur at Avalon, Apple Isle, these are often talked about, you know, in Celtic mythology.
Yeah.
And during the first four, and you can hear more about that in our History of the Kings of Britain series. So during the first forays by the Romans into Britannia and otherwise Gallic lands in the 1st century BCE, Romans like Julius Caesar and Marcus Tullius Cicero showed some respect, if patronizing in tone, to the Druids and their religious rites. Cicero himself was surprised at how well some Druids could augur the future like Romans, and Caesar would wrote extensively about his dealings with the Gauls, as we've discussed in this podcast. Of course, his respect for the Druids did not stop his wanton invasion of Gallic lands. Caesar and his contemporary Romans really viewed Britannia as this magical foreign land across the ocean, even as a different world. But the 1st century CE Romans came to conquer, and their tone had gotten much more murderous and disdainful of the practices of Britannia. Pliny the Elder speaks of the Roman emperors as wanting to eradicate the Druids of Britannia and install Romanitas. Remember, Pliny denounces the Druids as being cannibals and performing human sacrifice. Tacitus and Lucan take on similar tones. So the arrival of the Romans in Britannia would become a family affair to the ruling tribes of the island. The Iceni tribe of East Anglia and the Northern Brigantes tribe both suffered fallings out within their own ranks. For the Brigantes tribe, the queen Cardamandua was the reigning monarch and was a Roman ally as a client queen. Her consort and husband Venutius was staunchly anti-Roman. A British freedom fighter, Caraticus, fled to their court, but Cartamandua betrayed him to the Romans, leading to a falling out with Venutius. There is also the quite famous story of Boudica, which I'm sure many of our listeners have probably heard of at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there was even like a series maybe on Netflix or something like that dealt with it. I can't remember.
Yeah, that sounds like something that would have happened. I don't remember it specifically, but it feels like a show that there would have been. You know, especially after that show Vikings came out, there's been like a real string of that type of show. Do you remember the one that they did about, it was a German show, and it was about Arminius?
Yes.
That was a cool
I never
show.
Watched it, but I remember you telling me about that.
That was neat, and they did a pretty cool thing. They did it in modern German and Latin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is cool. Obviously, ancient Germanic would have been nothing like modern German. You know, not even close to mutually intelligible. Like, no ancient language is mutually intelligible.
I mean, even, like, medieval languages aren't really, like, fucking, like, medieval English. Middle English isn't, like, mutually intelligible with modern
English. I still remember the first part of Canterbury Tales in Middle English, and it's fucked.
Yeah.
It's fucked. Yeah. It's so different from, you know. And you can sit there and... I would say it's as easy to sit and, like, try to parse through as, like, you know, if you have a basic understanding of Spanish, like, reading Spanish. Like, it's that easy to understand if you're a native English speaker.
Yeah, or, like, just, like, looking at, like, Dutch or something like that.
Yeah, Dutch can sometimes be...
Yeah.
Like, what's that? There's a meme right now about how
we have an in serious problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. Like, you can definitely get like full sentences in Dutch. I remember watching like some video years ago of like, it was like a Dutch video of people talking about like psilocybin mushrooms.
Yeah.
And like, I remember watching it, I was like, I can like understand like entire sentences that they're saying occasionally. Yeah. Like, since,
I mean, that's
like
the closest, well, West Frisian is the closest to English, but that's the closest of the major like national languages to English.
Dutch is supposed to be like halfway in between German and English, but roughly about that. But yeah, so anyway, so you know, Boudicca, she's a pretty famous girl boss of history. So her husband was an Iceni pro-Roman client monarch named Prasutagus, which I love that name. And when he died, and his fortune and lands were divided to his daughters and to the Roman Emperor Nero. He wrote that into his will, that he would split it. However, upon his death, all of his assets were seized brutally by the Roman procurator, Decianus Catus, including the raping of the Icenian princesses and public flogging of Boudicca, according to Tacitus. Mm-hmm. This led Boudicca, his widow, to a famous rebellion against the Romans, and one that ended badly for her. Now, a potential cause of these divisions is that some of the pro-Roman client monarchs were sent to Rome for education and to learn the ways of the Romans, as we said before. And once they were brought up in Roman customs and laws, they would go back to Britannia as Romanized Britons, and this potentially caused schisms in the families. The continuance of Druidic practices into the Roman Empire post-1st century CE is a matter of debate. Suetonius, the man who wrote The Twelve Caesars, and who both Cameron and I have cited on this podcast before, and who we love and believe everything he says wholeheartedly, he claims that the Emperor Claudius fully eradicated Druidism. However, as we always point out, he was a gossipy little bitch and can't really be considered all that reliable of a source, entertaining as his writing is. There is some archaeological evidence in Roman Gallia, such as an unearthed pot in the ruins of a Roman house in Chartres, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, France. France, dating to the 2nd century CE. That potentially makes mention...
Sorry, yeah. I'm just laughing at... Yeah, in the fucking city of Chart.
I bet
we're going to get a fucking email from our...
Oh, yeah.
From our secret admirer.
Dude. Yeah, and you know what? Usually I do make, like, you know, in the Pont Saint-Esprit episode, I made an effort to learn all of the French pronunciations here. But, you know, for this one, for the Romans, I'm sorry, I don't care that much.
The Welsh lake that you mentioned earlier definitely isn't what you said.
What, Lyn Cerrig Brach?
Yeah, it's like Llyn, it's the double L is like a Llyn. Synthetic, bro. It's, I don't know, but it's Welsh is fucked.
Yeah, it is. Yes, but you know, that's how my American tongue will pronounce it. So
we're in Chart.
Yeah, we're in Chart. We're Charting. So it potentially makes mention of Druidic customs, and similar pots have been found with residues of mind altering drugs in both Roman Gallia and Britannia, including cannabis and other hallucinogenic compounds. So people just getting fucked up in their basements, just like doing like shit to like ithyphallic portrayals of gods and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So ithyphallic means full on fucking erect phallus.
Yeah, yeah.
I've
listened to Nile. I know the deal.
Well, I'm not telling you that. I'm telling all of the listeners who don't know.
Yeah. Well, you guys should listen to Nile.
Yeah. So these ceramic pots found in cellars of Roman ruins containing mind-altering drugs, of course, also bring to mind the mysteries of the East, as we've discussed in previous installments in this series. And, like, the mysteries these potentially druidic finds include magical spells. Of course, it's also possible here, hundreds of years into the Roman Empire, that whatever pot and spells were found in a 2nd century CE basement were a mishmash of different rituals and customs from all over the empire.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the conquest of Britannia by the Romans was limited to only a part of the island of Great Britain. And so the traditions of the Druids remained throughout the non-Romanized parts of the British and Irish Isles. And there are still references to Druids up into the medieval texts of Wales and Ireland, including Druidic practices after the Roman era. So yeah, like, the Romans would claim that they conquered Britannia, but, like, It was just like most of modern day England. They didn't really fuck around too much in Wales. Just, you know, it's very mountainous, so it's easier to defend. Yeah. And yeah, once they got to Scotland, they were just like, yeah, this fucking, these people can just throw around trees all they want up there. We don't really give a shit. It's not much up there.
Yeah.
Not
yeah,
much.
Yeah, I know. Like, the Scottish like to be all proud of that.
But it was just like the Romans looked at it and they were just like,
this sucks, man. It's just rocks and fucking grass.
Yeah. It's like this.
Keep it.
Yeah. Whatever, man. Yeah. You guys, we're just going to build a wall so you guys can just fuck off over there.
Right. So something I think to kind of reiterate as we're talking about, you know, the idea of these religious practices, and you're saying this, but I just am like bringing it up in like a more specific way. Like,
yeah.
Think about all of these tribes that the Romans just called Gauls or the British or Britons, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We are aware that there was a massive you can't talk about Native Americans, for example, as a monolith, right?
Yeah.
Because we're aware that even over a span of a few, like 100 miles, what we might in a modern sense think of as a single tribe or a single cultural group, there would be differences among, you know, different bands within that group. So, you know, you have to assume that the indigenous peoples of Britannia were equally diverse. And so what the Romans would describe in sort of these broad strokes and in pastiche is exactly that. It's just broad strokes. And so it's awesome to go back and kind of look at that. But it's one of the interesting things about historiography is that, you know, especially with the Romans, like anytime you're looking at, you know, Roman recorded history, you got to remember that they definitely weren't sitting down and interviewing people and trying to create an actual, like, accurate representation of the intricate tableau of cultures across their conquered territories.
Yeah.
They didn't have time for that shit. They like things to be simple and categorized in a simple way.
Yeah.
And so what we have surviving from them, and it's amazing that we have anything at all from that period, and we have to be thankful to the Romans for that, but they also didn't fucking... they didn't have the cultural sensitivity that you would hope that a modern historian would try to have.
Yeah. And like, another thing, too, is, like, definitely with, like, it not being, like, a monolith there either. Like, there were, like, tribes that welcomed the coming of the Romans because, like, they were, like... So, like, you had obviously stronger tribes and weaker tribes there.
Sure.
And, like, some of those, like, stronger tribes would, like, really subjugate the weaker ones and, like, brutalize them and all that. And so, like, a lot of those weaker tribes then... You know, they were, like, happy that the Romans came to, like, fuck up the other tribes that they didn't like. Stuff like that. And, like, even though they were, like, you know, we'd like total independence, but we prefer the Romans over these people that just keep fucking our shit up. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
And so, and yeah, and, like, and there's also, like, big differences, too. Like, you know, like I said earlier, like, the peoples along in, like, southeast England, you know, modern-day Kent, those were, like, mainly, like, Belgic peoples that had come over from Gaul and Germania and whatnot, whereas, like, you have, like, different peoples down, like, near where Cornwall is now and, like, up towards Wales and all that, so, like, there are, like, big differences in like, the technological advancement and also, you know, in terms of, like, and, like, the culture of these regions as well.
Exactly.
Yep. So... So, as we've discussed, you know, Rome came upon its conquest of Britannia in the first centuries BCE and CE during the Iron Age of Britain. This era of British history is scarce with primary literary sources, as the Britons did not really have a tradition of written chronicles. And, of course, the classical literary work spoke little of the island prior to the invasion. It's really with Caesar that we kind of, like, start to get to know these blue bastards. We, of course, have some references to the Druids as we've discussed, but the island really was shrouded in mystery here at the far end of the Roman world. There were, of course, local cults sprinkled around the island with a handful of recognizable shrines uncovered by archaeologists. Some of these include ones in the shape of the well-known Iron Age roundhouse, often depicted in media. I'm sure we've all seen, like, what a roundhouse looks like. Literally, it's just basically, like, this sort of, like, triangular thatched hut. You know, in, like, sort of, like, a circle shape going up to a point. You know, it's all thatches. Like, these aren't really, like, solid structures. You know, they're not really, like, permanent, like, the Roman structures of, like, stone and marble and all that. there's also, you know, in these roundhouses and whatnot, you could find, like, animal parts and pottery deposits found near specific entrances, possibly used as a ward for vulnerable parts of the house. There's also what's called structured deposits, where votive offerings, we've talked about the votive nature of the cults in previous episodes in this series. Votive offerings were left for denizens of the other world in a specific locale, like my pronunciation, Lin Kerikbak, or as Cam said, like, I don't even know how you make that sound. Lin Selikbak.
Something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Now, as
who cares?
As,
fuck whales. That's a hard take. Yeah. We mean it. We mean it. We don't care about whales.
Whales can be cool.
I'm kidding.
Whales can be cool. I'm cool with whales.
Of course we care about. Yeah, whales is great.
Yeah. Well,
I'm just saying in case anybody listening is like,
yeah.
Oh.
Or what's that? What's that fucking one insane town in Wales? I remember watching. I watched a video once of this. I'll try to find it and maybe put the clip in here. But it's like this news broadcaster, or like weather broadcaster.
He can say it. Yeah.
Yeah. He like got dared by like all the other ones to try to talk about the weather in that one town, and he fucking like nails it. Just like pronounces the whole thing. It's like insanely long.
Now today we had a big contrast in temperature across the UK, just 12 degrees over coastal parts of eastern England with cloudy skies, but in the sunshine in northwest Wales at RAF Mona, just up the road from Llanfair Pwllgwyng, Llangegera Cwndrobl, Llantysilio Gogogoch, the temperature got to 21 Celsius, that's 70 in Fahrenheit.
Yeah, so that town name is actually like a gimmick. It was a much shorter name, and it was still something, but they lengthened it in like the 80s or 90s for publicity, you know?
Yeah.
So it's exceptionally long.
Oh, yeah, it's like ridiculous. So
it's the longest in the world, or it was when they did that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like really bizarre, different mouth
a lot
movements
of consonants,
that you have to do. So, yeah, as we've discussed throughout the series, the Roman world was, of course, polytheistic. If you didn't realize that before this, I don't really know what to tell you. While we have been focusing on the mystery cults of various lesser deities that spread throughout the empire, and also the Mediterranean pre-Roman hegemony, and how these cults functioned both in their local areas as well as in the Roman Empire as a whole, and you talked about, you know, mainly with the cult of Mithras, that's been, like, a big focus. So as Rome came to new lands to conquer, they of course brought their own pantheon with them, but also the pantheons of other conquered peoples. So these would largely be spread through the auxiliary units and the military, which auxiliary here means like troops that were not Roman citizens and not part of the legions, but served some separate role, such as, you know, archers or skirmishers or cavalry. These were generally like some sort of like ethnic specialty, you know, like the horsemen of Hispania and stuff like that. So these auxiliaries would come from all over the empire and bring their strange gods to new lands as well. And sometimes those strange gods would grow in power back in Italy. So as the Romans came to Britannia, they brought their own cults, such as, of course, the, for lack of a better term, state religion of the imperial cult, that gave divine authority to the Romans through the dead emperors in the West, or the dead and living in the East, more or less, due to the already existing tradition in Eastern cultures of venerating the living ruler, e.g. the pharaoh. So, you know, in like Western Europe at this point, you know, they were still very anti-king, especially in like the Roman Empire, and anti-like king sentiment and whatnot. But in the East, you know, you really already have this like idea of like rulers as divinities, you know, the pharaohs of Egypt, obviously one, you know, the lands of Persia and all that, where, you know, you have like proskynesis to rulers and stuff like that. They're really like more than just people on earth.
Yeah.
And so like the imperial cult of Rome in the East was definitely more like the living emperors were kind of gods, but in the West they weren't until they died. So for the West, the worship of the living emperor was much more subdued, and rather the worship was more for the idea of rulership or the spirit of the empire. However, the further you got from Italy in the West, the more the actual veneration of the living emperor became pronounced, and you know, you see that more in Britannia. So this veneration would be a point of contention in Britannia, as the recently conquered people living in modest wooden huts would then have the Roman state erect massive marble monuments to the empire and temples to the Roman pantheon with statues of Emperor Claudius, who just conquered them on their own land, and began displacing the Britons for land for veteran legionaries. So you have all these, like, Britons, like, living in, you know, thatched huts and roundhouses, and then the Romans come, and they're just building these massive, like, marble monuments and much like nicer places to live and whatnot. That's where they're living. That's where like the legionnaires are settling. You know, this is a big thing in the Roman Empire that veteran legionaries would be given tracts of land as part of the real push for, you know, expansion. Mm-hmm. And so you would sort of displace the indigenous peoples for the legionaries. Although, like, I'd be pissed if I was, like, born in, like, Hispania, like, near the Mediterranean or, like, southern France or Italy, and then they're like, oh, yeah, here you go. You can live up here in Bath.
Yeah.
I'd be like, can I get Italy or something?
Yeah.
Can I get Sicily?
I don't want to go to Bath.
Yeah, this is...
I really liked Spain.
I like the warm water. Yeah,
yeah, it's nice down there. It's really
nice down
there.
Yeah, it's sun. You know, I've been killing folks for a long time for you assholes, and you're putting me up in stinky, misty island.
Like,
yeah,
I'm 35, dude. I got no foot.
Yeah,
I lost my foot.
Yeah, I'm stumping it up.
Bath?
Yeah,
I don't even get a bath. The place is just called Bath.
Well, there were bathhouses.
No, I know that's true. Nobody had baths in their house.
That's why it was called Bath. Because of the bathhouses.
I know. But I was saying, like, I don't even have a bath in my house. But I guess nobody probably... Maybe the emperors would... Really rich people would probably have a bath in their house. But
yeah. Yep.
Everybody was going to the public baths to bathe in that dirty, stinky fucking ball water.
Yeah, getting all kinds of weird fucking fungus and
shit. Pubes and shit. You come out, you just got pubes stuck to you from the water, dude.
Yeah.
Because they weren't trimming. There's no fucking way the Romans
And perhaps some of the people going to the water were not being quite hygienic with the sponge stick to clean their
shit in the water. Yeah, they were getting in there in the water and scrubbing their buttholes.
So ancient Roman version of ancient Roman toilet paper. This is like one of my favorite images I have saved on my phone, where it shows the ancient Roman sponge stick, and it says in the image, in parentheses, well known from literary sources. And like, so like, if you were like a patrician or somebody like that, you would take a shit and then then you would like lean over and spread them, and a servant would come up with this like wet sponge on the end of a stick and just fucking just scrape all the remainders off for you, you know. So
honestly, that's better than a lot of people were probably doing. I mean, these Britons probably just had poop caked in their butts.
yeah. Like, they were probably doing it, like, if you ever see a dog, outside, and they start, like, kind of walking, like, dragging their ass on the ground.
They got a muddy poop butt, dude. They got that itchy, muddy poop
so
butt.
You just see a bunch of blue bastards just in the bog, just kind of, like, scraping their ass on, like, the peat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1 o'clock?
Oh.
All right.
So this is part of the base. So, anyway, I like the lands being displaced and, like, the difference in development. You know, this is part of the basis of the rebellion of Boudica and the Iceni, or at least the reasoning for some of the people that joined in, like the Trinovantes. And as the Romans began their conquest of Britannia, the Druids began spreading prophecies of doom for the legions and the empire there.
Would you like to dance with me? We're doing the cosmic. that she was catching him. Hey, hear my mother call. I can hear my mother call. Late at night I hear a call. Oh, the Lord, I hear a call. She says, Father, Father, it's for the kids. Any and everything I did. Please, please don't judge me too strong.
To the growing resentment among the Britons towards the British was Roman speculative investment. Rich Romans, such as Lucius Aeneas Seneca, took advantage of the ample opportunities to make money in the new province with loans that they began to quickly foreclose and call in once tensions started to simmer. You know, they're just sitting there rubbing their hands together, ready to, like, make a bunch of money with, like, high-interest loans. And then once, like, shit started popping off, they're like, actually, you all have to give us this money back now. So, these loans were to tribal leaders in order to build roads, temples, etc., up to Roman standards. And the loans being called in obviously created economic hardship for the locals. You have the Romans snatching up the lands of the Britons for legionaries to settle on in retirement. You have Romans snatching up lands to build Roman bathhouses and temples and other projects. And you have loans being given at high interest to locals so they can help build up their areas. And then the Romans are immediately calling back in the loans as tensions start to rise. And on top of this, the Romans are stealing the territory of dead Roman loyalists, like Boudica's husband Prasutagus, who is assured that his territory would be passed on to his own upon his death. And you have the Romans waging war on the local Druidic orders. And so, when Prasutagus named the empire heir to half his fortune and lands, and the empire decided to take all, some Britons had had enough, and Boudica led them in a rebellion. Of course, she and her daughters were beaten and raped by the Romans, on top of having all of their lands and fortune seized.
Can you imagine getting that save the date announcement, the pending nuptials of Prasutagus and Boudica?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just silly.
Yeah. It's good couple names there.
Yeah, dude, Prasutagus.
Yeah, Pursuit of Kiss is so good. So Cassius Dio would write, after the fact, as he was born a century after these events, that Boudica herself held divine powers, including using a hare's movements to predict Roman movements. Must have been a Roman agent, that hare, considering she lost. Dio added some more salacious details to the final pitched battle, which, content warning here, because it's pretty brutal, that took place at a sacred grove, and included Boudica leading some profane ceremony wherein Roman women were impaled on stakes and had their breasts removed and sewn into their own mouths.
Damn.
Gnarly, yeah. So there is no real direct archaeological evidence even for the existence of Boudica, and it is entirely possible that she was a mythological creation by the Romans to represent the barbaric nature of the Britons. Long red hair, masculine appearance, and a harsh voice. Her name means victory, even. Now, there are some possible later archaeological links to Boudica, however, including a later tomb to a Boudicatia in the Roman-British town of Corinium that includes a tombstone depicting the god Oceanus, who sounds like something from a fantasy novel. The guard was purported, or the god, excuse me, was purported to guard the known world at the sea, with Britannia lying beyond, and featured long, flowing hair and beard with a crown of crab's claws. And yeah, this, like, really reminded me of something you'd see in, like, A Song of Ice and Fire. Like, something the people of Crack Claw Point and elsewhere in the Crown Lands would have worshipped before the coming of the Valyrians. Mm-hmm. There are the Celtigars, the Valyrian house that would rule Claw Isle off the coast of Crack Claw Point, had a coat of arms featuring red crabs, and there are stories about, like, crab people, if I recall correctly, and some of the, like, companion stuff to that series. But yeah, just like the crab claw crown god Oceanus was I liked that. It was a nice touch by the good job Britons. But yeah, so all this being said, I don't intend to paint the picture that the coming of the Romans was some universally detrimental and reviled act. The Eastern tribes certainly were taken advantage brutally of and subsequently revolted, but this was not a universal experience, and of course depended on the Romans that were put in charge of certain areas. You got good governors and bad governors, folks. For instance, Cassius Dio states that the Dobuni tribe of southern Britannia more or less welcomed the Romans, as they had been subjects of the Eastern tribes, and their incorporation into the empire was more or less peaceful under the governor Aulus Plautius. That's just a classic Roman name right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Romans, for the Dobuni, were welcomed as at least being more palatable than their previous Kedovalani overlords. So while in this series, and really this podcast in general, we often discuss or even laud the syncretic nature of religious integration into the Roman identity, I did want to use this particular expansion into Britain to also highlight how this integration was not some seamless, bloodless affair. The poet Juvenal wrote disparagingly in his satires about Gauls venerating barbaric animal deities, such as one Gaulish consul called Lateranus, worshipping the goddess of horses, Epona. You know, nice little thing for the Legend of Zelda fans here. The Romans, in large part, really did view Gaul and Britannia as barbaric, even as Eastern cults flourished and grew in strength in the empire. The mysteries flowed from east to west like the sun, to put it one way. Part of this was because of how much more advanced the East was to the West in integrating religious systems, and really in general. The East was a civilized and advanced area, from the Orient in Asia Minor to Egypt, Greece, and then to Italy. It was the West that was being brought up to speed, as it were, with its loose tribal confederations. Still, the integration of Western religious and mythological systems would change the nature of the mysteries and religious systems in the empire, although this was a bloody process, really no different than the East in that respect, I suppose, although the East influence back to its conquerors was maybe more pronounced. Of course, the East had much more ingrained religious tendencies, large stone temples dotting the landscape, written history, that kind of thing. The West was different. Religion was more silent, with the roundhouses described earlier. With the exception of things like Stonehenge, religion was worshipped in much less stable architecture and was more oral and less written. However, there was not really widespread religious persecution, save for the attempted annihilation of the Druids. But that was more a political act aimed at curtailing the power of the order than it was at eradicating them religiously. The problem with the Druids was that they were very like influential.
Right. They, yeah, they were like a ruling caste. It echoes the persecution of the Jewish religion by the Romans, which didn't really have anything to do with a particular distaste for the religious practices. The Romans were pretty into syncretic, religious syncretism. It was just that, you know, Jews tended to have a hard time with the notion of putting the Roman emperor first because
over God, over and the God. Same thing with the Christians.
The
universe,
and the Christians the same way. And the Christians went so far as to venerate a man, who to them is a god.
Yeah.
And so these are the sort of things that the Romans don't like. They don't like disruption to authority. You know, if you're if you can worship your god and still reliably send your tithes and your taxes, who really gives a fuck? It's when it starts to override their authority over you that they will persecute you for your religious beliefs.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah,
they're very practical in their racism and xenophobia.
Yeah. It's like, we don't dislike you because of your religion or your race. We just dislike you because your religion and race makes you not respect us the way that we demand respect. Yeah.
And also, you are worse than us.
Yeah. Also, yeah.
You just are worse.
I mean, look at your red hair, you fucking Gallic barbarian. That? Yeah. So yeah, as we've discussed in earlier editions of the series, the relationship between man and God in the ancient world was different from the one we see today. It was a very if-then votive relationship, wherein a request was made of the god or gods one was worshipping, and then an offering was made to appease such a request. It was, you were greasing the god's palms, really.
Yeah.
Is what it was.
It was transactional, yeah.
Absolutely it was. And once the transaction was complete, you can move on to a different one, because each god is involved in a different arena. Like, you're not gonna make a worship to the goddess of fortune to for something that doesn't have to do with needing good fortune. If you're fucking betting on a game, or if you're doing something on the battlefield, then you would make a votive offering to them. However, you wouldn't do it if you were trying to have a kid. You would go to a fertility goddess or something like that. So from this, we see that the Roman legions were really a massive force in spreading religion, and archaeologists uncover the heaviest footprints of cult worship and religion in regions of the Roman world where the Roman legions' concentration was strongest. In the cults of Mithras subseries of this series, we take an in-depth look at how that cult existed within the Roman world and Roman legions, and how the legions spread Mithras worship to all corners of the empire. In Britannia, it's in the areas where the legions are stationed heaviest that we see this syncretic blending of not only Roman cults, mysteries, and religions with British ones, but also the British ones presented in Roman manners. Sometimes this would manifest as the Romans finding the British gods that matched up with their own and presenting them alongside one another, or as one, with both names used. The legions also spread the worship of Jupiter Optimus Maximus, Jupiter Optimus Maximus, through the observance of the imperial cult. And every January 3rd, on Jupiter's birthday, a new altar to the god was erected in locales, while the previous years was ceremonially buried and commemorated. Individual soldiers would give votive offerings to Mars, the god of war, for the success of the emperor or emperors, depending on the year, in military campaigns. There are archaeological finds of bronze statues of Mars and personally dedicated by soldiers, sometimes totaling multiple weeks' worth of pay from a single soldier to dedicate the statue to the campaign. However, depending on the region of Britannia that these votive offerings are found, the style of the god depicted can change from the more classical style of Rome's Mars to a more British style, with spear and shield and a prominent phallus. Even the spear's point is shaped like a phallus.
Nice,
obviously, Romans were into tiny penises, tiny flaccid dicks.
They didn't like, a big dick.
I mean, the dicks were shorter than the balls, even.
Yeah.
However, the Britons, they were slinging wild hogs on their depictions.
Absolutely.
The British style of Mars, would be ithyphallic with an ithyphallic spear. Also, these renderings tend to be much cruder. And they have like large heads, and a lot of times with horns as well. Horns were big in British depictions. There was a British war god from the north named Bela Tukidris, or Bela Tukidris. Not really sure how to pronounce that, but he was called
Bela Tukadros.
Yeah. But he was called the Fair Killer, who was worshipped around Hadrian's Wall. He was sometimes called Mars Bela Tukadris in the Roman era. He was not the only war god that was likened to Mars, but an example of a horned one, similar to the description previously of the dick-wielding gentleman. Another one is Cocytus, a.k.a. the Red God, I'm thinking due to the blood. Cocytus was a warrior god in the northwest of Britannia, but in the east he was likened to the hunter god Sylvanus. Another Mars-type god that made its way to Britannia was from the German cohort and named Mars Thinxus. There are inscriptions to Mars Thinxus alongside two German goddesses unassigned to Roman goddesses, the Alesiagae, Beta and Femilena. These inscriptions come along with devotions to the imperial cult. On top of Mars, the legions also brought to Britannia worship of the goddesses Fortuna and Nemesis, chance and fate. Two things you want on your side when engaging the enemy in battle. Neither of these goddesses were inherently warlike, but giving votive offerings to them on the battlefield could prove fortuitous, or so a Roman legionary thought. One form of fortuna here was as Fortuna Redux, or the Homebringer, and shrines to this form of fortuna could also invoke healing deities like Asclepius and Sallust. Nemesis, as the bringer of fate, was invoked at times in curses, in gladiatorial settings, and also at sites of game betting. So Nemesis would eventually, obviously judging by the name Nemesis, or like what Nemesis means to us now, would eventually kind of become something that you would, you know, damn Nemesis or something like that. But like in the early days, Nemesis was more like the one who like follows Fortuna. They were really invoked together oftentimes. Yeah. And yeah, if you were trying to curse somebody, you would invoke Nemesis. And so Nemesis would become their nemesis.
Yep.
So another obvious goddess worshipped in Britannia brought by the legions was Victoria, the goddess of victory. That one seems fairly obvious. Mm-hmm. The cult of the mother goddesses, which had been born in Gaul, was brought to the island by the legions as well. The Matres, also known as the Matronae in Germania, were three goddesses, or occasionally three aspects of a single goddess, of motherhood and fertility, popular among legions of Britannia, Germania, and Gaul. The exact nature of their popularity in Britannia is uncertain, but it was likely as protectors and keepers of the well-being of soldiers. As we mentioned earlier, the Gallic horse goddess Epona was brought to Britannia likely by auxiliary cavalry troops. Worship was big among the Spanish cavalry auxiliaries, and inscriptions by such units have been found on the island. Interestingly, among these troops, Epona, again a Gallic goddess, seems to have been worshipped as highly as the Roman martial deities. The British deity Antenocyticus, an entirely British name with no added Roman name, has had visages uncovered around Hadrian's Wall. Little is known about the deity, but his cult was high in the pantheon, and his devotees included high-ranking legionaries and auxiliaries. The visage of this god is in the British style, as opposed to the Roman, and he appears young and possibly to be sporting a couple of horns, although there's some debate if it's just a weird hairstyle.
Mm.
As I said, not much is known, but his high-ranking cult was likely short-lived with its peak in the mid-2nd century CE, but whether he was from Gaul or Britannia or was made up by the legions themselves is unknown. There is also the cult of the goddess Brigantia, namesake of the Brigantes tribe, and worshipped by those people in the legion stationed nearby. She was presented as a warrior woman armed with a shield and trident. Yeah. So yeah, you know, as we've discussed in this episode, the exact nature of worship in Britannia in pre-Roman times is tough to parse exactly owing to the oral tradition of the island and its less sturdy constructions as houses of worship. The Druids acted as both a religious and a political order, and when the Romans came to the island, they sought to quell or totally subdue the Druids in order to instill Romanitas among the people and the region. The coming of the Romans marked outbreaks of violence and revolts, but these were put down by the conquerors, and the legions stationed on the island would bring gods from elsewhere in the empire to Britannia, and the local deities would intermingle with the Roman ones and produce a new flavor. So next time we will dive deeper into what the nature of cult worship on Britannia was, and how the mystery cults from the east found their way to the island, and how the worship changed.
Hmm.
Next time on this series, not next episode. But...
next time on the next install on Ancient Mysteries Part 7,
British Roman cult, Britannia, Roman Part Britannia, 2.
Part 2.
Yeah.
episode to be determined of Left Unread.
Yeah, we are entering anime naming conventions territory here.
For sure. This is a good time to remind you all that we if you use Spotify, which is great, then you can find our playlist, which is called LU Series.
Yeah.
L like the letter L, U like the letter U, Series, where Evan will have this socketed in right with the rest of the Ancient Mysteries episodes, and you can just listen to them in order. This series, I think you would probably agree, is less narrative, but it still benefits. It still builds on each other, and so you know, when we group things in series like this, it's just because we feel like thematically they're companion pieces, and so you can go back and listen to all of them.
Yeah,
and you can hear about people peeling each other's dicks off and stuff. It's great.
Yes. Yeah. There's a whole series about people just. Fuck it. Or a whole parts about people that just decided to castrate themselves on the fly because they're having such a good time.
And, you know, maybe if they'd had the option of a Panuma back then, they wouldn't have been so quick to give up what they had. But, you know.
If Dr. Ellis was in the ancient world, he would have been mauling dicks a little bit differently than they were.
His name was Ellis Gabalus, and he was...
good one.
Yeah, thanks. You know what I was thinking about the other day? You know what I think one of my favorite jokes I've ever made in my entire life was? And it was on this show.
Okay.
It was when we did an ad, and I don't even remember what it was for. It was some, like, Roman sex toy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, like, you'll say, Veni, Veni, Veni.
Yeah. That was
I was really proud
I laughed
of that.
Pretty hard at that. I do
that
remember.
Was a fucking good one.
Yeah, Veni, Veni, Veni. Anyway, so yeah, also, I've had a few people reach out. Some of our early episodes are no longer up on any like podcast host, and I believe that's because we need to increase the rate that we pay for hosting fees. So that parlays me into saying that if you would like to support the show, you can find us on patreon.com/leftunread. And you can choose, if you so wish, if you enjoy the show, you can choose to give us a small monthly donation.
Oh, yeah. The first 15 episodes aren't there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think we're down to there. We're only allowed to host 100 right now based on our pay rate. So, the cost is going up for us. So if you would like to help us out, you can support the show by signing up for a small monthly fee, and eventually once we're growing in size.
Oh yeah, the first two histories of the kings of Britain aren't there. We got to do this. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna fix this before this episode's even out, folks.
Yeah.
So don't worry. If you're hearing this, you'll be able to hear all of our episodes. Mm-hmm. But just know that it came at personal cost.
Yeah,
money to do this for you.
Yes, so, exactly. So you could help us out a little bit by giving us a small monthly fee. And eventually, once we get to about 50 subscribers, give or take, we will start doing bonus content for those that we look upon more favorably than our listeners who are just mooching, just here for the ride. But if you can't afford to give us any money, that's fine. We understand. You can support the podcast in other ways. You can rate, review, and you can rate and review us on your podcast app of choice. And we also spread by word of mouth, so you can tell your friends, family, coworkers, random people that you meet on the street, whatever. You can tell them about us. That really helps to get us to spread the word. So we do appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right,
shit.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you have nothing else to add, then I guess I know you gotta go. You got a busy day for the rest of the day, so
yeah, it's true.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in, and I guess we will see you next time.
Yep, we'll see you next time here on what's the show called again?
Cam and Evan's Suck and Fuck Hour.
We'll see you next time.
Yep. Bye.
Right, bye.
behave. And when they go to church, they don't listen to what the preacher's saying. He's saying God can give you anything you want. He's saying God can give you anything you want. He's saying God can give you anything you want. He's saying God can give you anything you want. Tell me anything you want. We'll be right back.